I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
We start with an update on developments in the war in Iraq. Appearing in military uniform on Iraqi television today, Saddam Hussein told Iraqis that coalition forces have failed to crack Iraq's resistance. Military analysts say the appearance is the strongest evidence yet that Hussein is still alive. Just hours later, CNN aired footage of a purported Hussein walking the streets of Baghdad surrounded by a supportive throng.
The Iraqi information minister also took to the airwaves today in a press conference and promised what he called unconventional action against Allied troops before tomorrow.
Tonight we're going to do untraditional act against them. It's not a military action. We are going to do something against them which will be an example, which is marvelous example.
The minister also said that Saddam International Airport, renamed Baghdad International Airport by American forces, will become a graveyard for coalition troops. Military analysts say he's likely to be referring to terrorist acts, not chemical or biological weapons.
U.S. troops are searching the tunnels running underneath the airport in Baghdad, looking for any Iraqi soldiers who might be hiding there. This after seizing the airport in an overnight infantry assault.
Thousands of Iraqi civilians are fleeing Baghdad as anticipation of the siege on the Iraqi capital grows. Hundreds of trucks, buses, and cars are backed up for miles as they head north.
Atlantic Monthly editor and Washington Post columnist Michael Kelly was killed along with an American soldier this morning in Baghdad following an accident involving their Humvee. During his 23-year career as a journalist, Kelly also worked at the New York Times, New Republic magazine, and the Boston Globe.
U.S. troops say they've found thousands of boxes of white powder, a nerve agent antidote, and Arabic instructions on how to engage in chemical warfare at an industrial site 25 miles south of Baghdad.
Embedded reporter with the 101st Airborne Division, Don North, says the southern city of Najaf is now firmly under Allied control. He describes the scene there today.
I've just returned from a reconnaissance patrol through the city, and it's very different from what I saw when I first got here 4 days ago. Shops are opening, more people in the streets, and they're coming out waving at our trucks and convoys, very friendly.
2,500 Republican Guard soldiers south of the city have surrendered to Marines, according to American officials.
And finally, humanitarian aid is starting to trickle into the southern part of the country. U.S. Army Colonel David Blackledge says fresh water is now flowing in Qasr. In the meantime, Doctors Without Borders confirms that two members of its Baghdad aid team have been missing since yesterday.
Worldwide, there are now almost 2,500 cases of severe acute respiratory syndrome. You probably know it better by its acronym by now, SARS. 84 people in 18 countries have died, including the doctor who first recognized the flu-like illness and severe pneumonia as a new disease. There are 100 suspected cases in the United States, but the most serious outbreaks of SARS are in Toronto and East Asia. The World Health Organization is recommending that people do not travel to Hong Kong and the province of Guangdong in China. Officials at the Centers for Disease Control say it's not clear whether a global pandemic can be avoided. And already, the chief economist of Morgan Stanley has predicted that fear of SARS will cause a global recession. Megan Murray is an epidemiologist and infectious disease physician at the Harvard School of Public Health. Hello, Dr. Murray.
Hello.
Doctor, I understand the actual virus that causes SARS is unknown. What is SARS?
Well, it is a group of symptoms. So when people talk about SARS, they're talking about a disease that's defined by contact with someone with the disease, travel from Asia, and then a series of symptoms. The disease begins with fever, chills, headache, aches and pains, and goes on to have respiratory symptoms a few days into the illness. And the respiratory symptoms can become a pneumonia that requires hospitalization and mechanical ventilation. At this point, I think most people think that the culprit organism is a coronavirus.
Where does a virus spring from like that?
Well, it's rare that a new organism just appears. When that happens, it usually comes from some kind of animal source. In this case, it may well be chickens.
Doctor, how serious is the infection?
Well, it's hard to know exactly. It's clearly serious enough to have caused a lot of deaths. At this point, I think we're talking about 80 to 100 deaths worldwide. But we don't know who has it. So we know people who are sick enough to come into the hospital, and we can estimate a death rate among people who are identified as having the illness. But it's possible a lot of other people have the illness, and they're not sick enough to actually come in. So we can't actually say what the case fatality rate is.
How does one catch the disease?
This is a respiratory virus, so there are several possible routes. There's person-to-person transmission, meaning that one can get it from contact with another person with it. That might occur from droplets that someone picks up either on their hand, from touching their face, or through the air. It's pretty clear that at least some transmission occurs through the air because of the apartment building in Hong Kong in which a lot of people were infected who weren't in direct contact with the sick person.
How infectious is this disease?
We think that the secondary attack rate, which means the number of people who have been exposed to get disease, is about 50%. That means it's pretty infectious. It's less infectious than something like measles and more infectious than something like, say, smallpox.
How concerned should members of our audience in the United States be about SARS?
Well, there are not that many cases reported in the U.S. so far. I think that today we don't have to be that concerned about getting SARS, but it's quite possible that SARS will become transmitted in the U.S. And then I think we actually do need to be quite worried about it.
So what's the future of this disease based on the pattern of spread so far?
Well, the issue is that we think this is a virus that hasn't affected humans in the past, which means that everyone is completely susceptible to it. What limits spread of infectious diseases and viruses in particular is immunity. So if you have something like measles, most people in a population are immune, either through previous infection or through a vaccination. And those people act to block the spread of diseases. When no one is immune, a virus has a much better chance of spreading. And the first epidemic is the big one, when the entire population is susceptible.
Doctor, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Sure. Thank you.
Megan Murray is an epidemiologist and infectious disease physician at the Harvard School of Public Health.
Women in war have often been in harm's way. 200 nurses were killed by enemy fire in World War II. 88 military women were captured by the Japanese, and many survived the Bataan Death March. But the rescue of POW Private Jessica Lynch in Iraq has raised the question again about the role of women in combat. Lori Manning is a retired U.S. Navy captain and director of the Center for Women in Uniform. And Captain Manning, what exactly are the existing rules governing women in combat?
The basic rules are that women are not allowed in ground combat occupations or ground combat units. And that means special forces of all kinds, infantry, armor, which are the tanks or the Marine Corps amphibious vehicles, most field artillery. They are allowed in the long-range field artillery, and Navy submarines. And the bar on the submarines has got to do with privacy, not the combat aspect of it.
If the thinking isn't about keeping women out of harm's way, What is the thinking behind keeping women out of combat?
It's the thinking is national security. In other words, are they physically strong enough to fight over the long haul, to run 7, 8, 10 miles carrying 75 or 100 pounds on their back, as can happen often in the infantry.
Well, let's talk about Private Lynch, because even though she was in a supply line, reports are that she fought fiercely, shot several enemy soldiers. I could see many women in the military looking at that and saying, if that's not combat, I don't know what is.
Well, it seems like combat to most people. All soldiers, male or female, are taught how to handle themselves in the sort of situation in which Private Lynch and the others found themselves. They all know how to shoot a weapon. They all know how to work as a team. It's part of the training now. That didn't used to be. We used to have the women out there, sometimes in very dangerous positions, as those nurses in World War II, without any of that sort of training.
Yeah. Well, they've had the training.
Yes.
You might be needed to pick up that weapon and protect yourself or your fellow soldiers. So what do you see happening?
Well, what I see is after this is over, particularly within the Army and the Marine Corps, the two services that are mostly on the ground, You know, they'll be looking at what the women did, how they handled themselves, and then making recommendations and decisions on, do we go further with what we have our women doing, or do we try to roll it back? I think we'll have a national discussion about it.
What are you seeing women increasingly doing that has them, you know, creeping towards that equality?
A lot of the women over there are being used to question and search Iraqi women, for instance. They are picking up weapons and defending when they have to. They're guarding Iraqi prisoners of war. Some of the women MPs are involved in some of the searches through empty buildings and stuff, which can be very dangerous.
Do you think the images of female POWs may have a negative impact on a national discussion?
Mm-hmm. Certainly, from the commentary I've heard, there are people that would like to take that and spin it to their own ideological purposes to roll back the role of women. And I think that will be part of the discussion, because they'll be part of the discussion, too.
Well, ideology is one thing, but then there are Americans who just, you know, might be realizing, I don't want to see that.
Well, there are people who think that. The question is, do we make our national security policy based on what some couch potato feels or what our women are physically capable of doing? If we're going to lock up our women because they might be in danger, we might as well go to the Taliban.
Well, and statistically, it may not be something we can afford. We read now women make up about 15% of the U.S. armed forces. That's a number that's nearly doubled since 1980. It's up by a third since the 91 Gulf War. And more than 90% of service positions are open to women. Statistically, can we afford to cut women out of combat?
If we want an all-volunteer force, we are going to have women in it, and we're going to have single fathers, married couples, all those things that we talk about. But the only alternative to that is a draft.
Captain Manning, what about anecdotes we're reading, one in yesterday's Christian Science Monitor, I know you saw it, about a platoon leader cautioning her soldiers not to level some buildings, saying she didn't want to get all aggressive. That's part of the quote.
The idea of being a good soldier is the controlled use of aggression and force, not the let's level everything, let's break and kill everything. That's not a good soldier. She, in my mind, was the good soldier.
How can you be a platoon leader with an infantry division and be a woman, and women aren't supposed to be in combat?
She's a helicopter pilot.
So
she's not actually in the infantry. She's giving support to them.
It sounds like in more ways than one.
Yes, I think so.
Yeah. Well, Lori, thank you so much.
Great talking with you.
Lori Manning is a retired U.S. Navy captain and director of the Center for Women in Uniform.
Just ahead, every picture tells a story, but an altered L.A. Times picture told a lie. We consider the sensitive role of photojournalism in wartime.
Also, liberal Village Voice writer Nat Hentoff on why he's not protesting this war.
And later, Sigourney Weaver on the first movie to take on the topic of September 11th.
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Most of us must see the war in Iraq through the eyes of the men and women photographing it. So a question then, are we getting a true picture? Monday, the Los Angeles Times put a large photo on page one of a U.S. soldier, his arm raised and shoulder slung, rifle leveled toward a large crowd, as a man with a baby in the foreground of the picture seemingly cowered, as if imploring the soldier for something. It's a tense, poignant moment. But it never happened. The photographer who took the picture digitally altered it by combining parts of images from a series of photos he'd taken of the scene. He portrayed the soldier when his arm was at its most dramatic tilt. He added a few people to the crowd, and he moved the cowering man with the child into the picture's foreground. The photographer was fired. So this week, on our editorial roundtable, the power and ethics of images. Joining us on the line are Nolan Finley. He's editorial page editor of the Detroit News in Detroit, Michigan. Hi, Nolan.
Hey, Bill.
And Kenny Irby. Kenny's group leader of visual journalism at the Poynter Institute in St. Petersburg, Florida. Welcome, Kenny.
Good morning, Bill.
Kenny, your most compelling image, and then I'm going to ask Nolan the same thing, so far in this war.
I think that's an unfair question to all the people who are out there. I mean, there are so many compelling images. One of the images that I think still stays with me is the James Hill New York Times picture of the dead Iraqi soldier laying on the road as the U.S. Marine walks off into the orange cloud. I think that was on March the 28th, which was one of the first pictures that we saw. A second picture that stays with me is a picture of two enemy soldiers. They had been killed in a firefight, and it was just the pictures of their feet, their mangled feet, and their dress shoes in the desert sand. And that's a powerful symbolic image for me right now.
Nolan?
Well, two pictures. Neither one of them have anything to do with combat. The first is the picture that USA Today ran on its front page a week or so ago of the young private cradling an Iraqi child in his arm and rushing him to safety. The other was a group of Marines standing around with an Iraqi family at graveside after they had helped this family bury a family member who had been killed in the fighting. And to me, you contrast that with the images of American soldiers you had following the Vietnam War, you know, the Apocalypse Now, Full Metal Jacket images that came out of these drug-crazed, paranoid killers, and you contrast that with these images of very human, very compassionate soldiers, and I think it's very, very powerful.
Kenny, what do you know about photos of the American public, the American reading public in particular, in their newspapers may not be seeing because they're too disturbing? There was a photograph by a Dallas Morning News photographer of a dead body that never ran in his own paper that did run in the L.A. Times and Canada's Globe and Mail. There was a picture of an injured Iraqi girl. In the United States, the photo was cropped, leaving out the part that showed her shredded foot. The whole image ran in foreign papers, and in fact, the Arab press tends to be showing much more gruesome photos than the U.S. press. Your thoughts?
That is absolutely a reality. I mean, I think that in an American society, that the censorship and the editing processes that are applied are very different, and they're related to the culture. I think in some ways there's a provincial ethic that's being carried out in America where if it's too difficult to meet the breakfast test or the morning cereal test or the possibility that a child might see it, American media tend to shy away from those publishing those pictures. And it's not a right or wrong. It is a fact of presenting a more accurate and relevant truth. It is a really difficult call. Small-town community newspapers, I'm a party to several conversations, both on listserv and with counseling and consulting to a lot of picture editors and newsroom editors who are asking these difficult questions about how far is too far and what is appropriate to bring a relevant and accurate representation visually.
Nolan?
I'm looking at one of our inside pages today, and you know, we have three pictures out of the war. One shows a very heated firefight. The other shows soldiers at rest on a battleship, and another shows a soldier cradling a newborn baby. So you're getting a very good range of pictures, and I think the readers have a good idea, readers and viewers, a good idea that war is a very messy, gory thing. I'm not so sure they need to see all of that blood on their front page or want to see all that blood on their front page.
Now, Nolan, you, of course, have a large Arab community in
right.
Detroit.
Absolutely.
Are they demanding any different coverage than your viewers who are not Arabs?
Well, I mean, that's an ongoing thing. You know, everyone has a different view of what's what objective means. So
and the key in the pursuit of objectivity, and I don't think we'll ever reach it. But the reality is that we do have to present a balanced view that helps our reviewers, and that would be readers and viewers of TV and print and multimedia material, have a comprehensive understanding so that they can make fair decisions with a variety of information and understanding.
Well, this is you might classify this as the first ever e-war, and viewers and readers and anyone interested can get really some unfiltered images of this war simply by going to their computer, turning on their television. You're almost watching this war as it unfolds, and you know there's probably a better opportunity than ever before for readers and viewers to make up their own minds about what's going on.
I think that's true, and that adds to the degree of difficulty and complexity for print organizations in particular to ferret out after the fact, for the most part, in their print publications, what are the appropriate pictures that give and offer analysis and context to the understanding of the images that are zipping forward in front of them on TV screens.
Excellent point.
Regardless of the means that have precipitated this issue, the end right now is that we have a stronger perspective about the Persian Gulf region, the people, I think, so that culturally we have a better understanding about the world around us.
Nolan Finley and Kenny Irby, I want to thank you both for joining our editorial roundtable today.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you, Bill, and thank you, Nolan.
Thanks.
Nolan Finley is editorial page editor of the Detroit News in Detroit, Michigan. Kenny Irby is group leader of visual journalism at the Poynter Institute in St. Petersburg, Florida.
And to see some of these war photographs, check out our website, here-now.org.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, coalition forces engage in a firefight at a bridge on the road to Mosul. We hear the sounds of war from northern Iraq.
Also, traditional voice of the left and of the village voice, Nat Hentoff, on why he's not protesting the war with Iraq.
These stories, and actress Sigourney Weaver talks about making The Guys, the first feature film about the September 11th attacks. Coming up, Here and Now.
I'm Marianne Nichols. Iraqi state television is broadcasting a video of a man identified as Saddam Hussein walking outside in a small crowd of people. It's not clear when the video was made, and White House officials say there is no way to tell if the uniformed man identified as Hussein in the footage is the Iraqi leader. Meanwhile, U.S. intelligence officials say a video address released earlier today may be the latest message made by Hussein since the start of the war. In the message, he referred to the downing of a U.S. helicopter on March 24th. White House officials say President Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair are planning a two-day summit in Northern Ireland next week, the third such meeting in as many weeks. They are planning to discuss the war in Iraq, as well as peace efforts to be made in the Middle East and Northern Ireland. Meantime, administration officials say President Bush is scheduled to meet with a group of Iraqi exiles to highlight the brutality of the Iraqi regime. A boat hijacking in Cuba is over. Cuban officials say the hijackers of a ferry are under arrest and the nearly 50 hostages are safe after their rescue by Cuban security forces. The hijackers are said to have been trying to get to the United States. Cuban authorities had chased the boats to a port near Havana on Wednesday after pursuing it in international waters. A federal appeals court in New York has upheld the conviction of a mastermind of the 1993 World Trade Center bombing and plot to blow up jets over the Far East. The court affirmed the convictions of Ramzi Youssef and his accomplices. The 1993 bombing killed six people and injured more than 1,000 others. A small twin-engine plane crashed into a sheet metal building in northern Massachusetts this morning, leaving five people dead. Federal Aviation Administration investigators are on the scene. Two people survived the flight, while all seven of the employees in the building escaped. Joe Cordio owns the North End Diner, located across the street from the crash site.
The building is engulfed in flames and a lot of black smoke coming out of it. Emergency apparatus is everywhere, from state police to fire trucks to voluntary help from all the surrounding towns.
The FAA is now trying to determine where the plane took off. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow is up 156 points at 82.56. The Nasdaq is down 12 points at 13.84. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
WBUR's Michael Goldfarb has been traveling in northern Iraq with coalition forces, and this morning they were involved in a firefight at a bridge on the road to Mosul. He joins us now on the line. Michael, what happened?
Well, Robin, over the last 48 hours, the Iraqis have been vacating positions along a ridge that separates Erbil, where I'm speaking to you now, from Mosul. There's two ridges between here and Mosul. Mm-hmm. And they've fallen back about 20 kilometers. And coalition forces, Peshmerga and special forces, have been working to occupy the positions the Iraqis just walked away from. Yesterday, they came to a bridge over a tributary of the River Zab, and this is a critical bridge because the roads from the three big cities in Kurdistan, Duhok, Erbil, and Sulaymaniyah, all meet here and go over this bridge. Their mission is very clearly to preserve infrastructure, and they're trying to prevent the Iraqis from blowing up this bridge. Anyway, I was standing on a little hill looking down at the river and the bridge, talking to some Green Berets who were coordinating airstrikes on Iraqi positions, and we came under fire.
That was a pretty good one there, man.
Yeah, it was.
That's close. That's one of the close ones. You got any
gotta love that sound.
Yeah. Best when you hear that sound. Because if you didn't hear it, guess what? Did you hear the boom?
Like that?
Get out.
Come on.
So after that second explosion, which was about 100 meters away, we jumped into the back of the customized Range Rovers that the Green Berets are using. There's an empty flat space in the back where they pack their radio gear. And they drove us about 200 yards away to get out of the line of fire, we thought.
Yeah, I'm on the way.
You got the rain. Yeah.
Load them up. Hey, you guys can get in and get a ride because it's probably going to get airy once they get it prepped.
Okay. That third shot was about it, and we really did have to get out of there.
What is your sense then, Michael, because we've spoken to you during the week and you've been telling us how the Iraqi forces seem to be withdrawing. Are these stragglers?
No. What happened today, as was explained to me by the Green Berets, is that they have this one large Russian-made mobile howitzer called a D-30. Shoots a 105-millimeter shell, which is quite loud. And what they do is they vacate positions, but the howitzer, which is mobile, will take up a position and start firing at the people pursuing them. The Green Berets then call in airstrikes, and the howitzer moves. And so basically, there's sort of like a massive game of chess in which, you know, you're down to one last piece, which is your king, the howitzer, and it's being chased round about the board. And when I left the area, checkmate had not been reached yet.
Michael, before we let you go, any sense of injuries or fatalities?
We were very lucky. Nothing happened to us. And in fact, the Green Berets, who were under fire from that gun all of last night, as well as sporadic rifle fire, haven't taken any injuries, nor have the 90-odd Peshmerga Kurdish fighters who are fighting with them.
WBUR's Michael Goldfarb. Michael, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
For more on Michael's reporting from northern Iraq, go to our website, here-now.org.
Nat Hentoff, if you're a New Yorker or a reader of The Village Voice or a jazz lover or just somebody who's kept an ear to the ground of the culture for the past, 50 years or so, you probably know Nat Hentoff, mostly a man of the political left who took to the streets to protest Vietnam and has opposed many another U.S. intervention. Nat Hentoff has not, though, and says he will not, protest the war in Iraq. To explain, Nat Hentoff now joins us on the line from his office in New York. Nat, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. Well, to explain, as a matter of fact, apparently The Voice has gotten more letters than usual, most of them denouncing me. So the best way to explain is briefly to answer their main points. One of them says, opposition to Bush's war has nothing to do with Hussein, just as the invasion has nothing to do with the long suffering of the Iraqi people. So my question would be that who will end that suffering, who would have ended that suffering without the invasion, and when? Then somebody else says, anyone who truly wants to see the Iraqi people liberated should support the resistance against the war. Nobody has answered the question, how would the resistance of the war have ended? Let us say, I'm now quoting from Amnesty, Human Rights Watch, the cutting out of tongues of Iraqis suspected of disloyalty to the regime. And then finally, somebody says, should we invade all the countries on the list of Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch? The point is, this is the immediate, extraordinary suffering of a people. And does that letter writer believe, for example, should we have not stopped the genocide in Rwanda because the United Nations, when Kofi Annan was the peacekeeping guy, refused to intervene?
Yeah, but Nat, isn't there something wrong with bringing such violence to bear on a country in order to end other violence? Doesn't violence always breed more violence?
All of that's true. I still want an answer to the question. The torture chambers are real. They found some more of them during the invasion. But how are you going to end all that suffering? Nobody has come up with an answer. The UN is useless in these matters. The peace marchers never said one word, not one word about the torture chambers.
Have you given up on the UN, on multilateral action?
The UN is important and vital for feeding people, for humanitarian purposes, but Eleanor Roosevelt's dream of the UN is being of any use whatsoever when you have some of the worst perpetrators are on the Human Rights Commission. That's crazy.
So do you think there should be a new, more muscular U.S. military policy than ever?
No, I'm talking about specific situation. I've been following what's going on in Iraq as I have in Sudan. I've been writing for years about something that most people pay no attention to, the genocide, the slavery, the raping of women in the south of Sudan by the National Islamic Front government in Khartoum.
Well, why not go into the Sudan and stop it with military force?
I would think that if the United Nations could be moved to do that, but Kofi Annan has never said a word about the Sudan.
So it becomes a case-by-case basis.
That's right. Took me months to come to this conclusion about Iraq. And sure, it's a terrible paradox. You inflict suffering to end the suffering. And I ask all these people I've known for years, what else is the answer? And nobody came up with an answer. And that's why I think the peace people, and most of whom, as I say, are long-term friends of mine, should at least have raised that question in all the demonstrations, on all the placards, etc. It's an unanswerable question unless you look at it very closely and come to a personally terrifying decision.
Nat Hentoff, we want to thank you so much for speaking with us.
Okay.
Nat Hentoff, the longtime author, critic, Village Voice writer, who now supports the war in Iraq.
Still to come, the story of a journalist who helps write eulogies for firefighters who died on September 11th. Sigourney Weaver takes the guys from stage to screen.
You're listening to Here and Now.
There are about 255,000 U.S. troops in Iraq. There are also another 25 soldiers who are not there. Approximately 14 have been granted conscientious objector status, and 11 more are being considered. J.P. Burnham can relate to both groups. J.P. is a Tennessee mother with two sons in the Army. One, Taylor, is a combat engineer in Iraq. The other, Travis, has applied for CO status and is awaiting his fate at Fort Drum in New York. We spoke to J.P. a few weeks ago about her family. As troops enter Baghdad, we wanted to check in again. And J.P. Burnham joins us on the line from Johnson City, Tennessee. J.P., nice to talk to you again.
Hello. Thank you very much.
Well, when we spoke last, you said you were supporting both of your boys. Now the fighting's actually underway. Has that changed?
The support has grown stronger, if at all possible. Yeah. Absolutely. Much stronger, much more emotional.
Well, and let's talk about both of the boys. First of all, where is Taylor in Iraq? Have you heard from him?
He had written a friend, and she called me last evening. That's the first time we have heard since the conflict started. But I don't know where he is. He's a combat engineer, and all he said in the letter, they were attached to Marines.
He's boots on the ground in Iraq, then.
Correct. He absolutely is.
So, you know, what's this been like for you?
Pure emotional hell. I'm glad that we have the embedded reporters, and that's a mixed blessing because we watch. I never went to bed last night. I just stayed up and watched because of some of the battles that had occurred.
Well, now, what about Travis? Last time we talked, he was in the middle of applying for conscientious objector status.
Right.
We know it's a long process. Did he get it?
They were supposed to have had a hearing, as I understand it, by April 9th. And I spoke to him a couple nights ago, and the Army,
for the first time in two,
appointed the hearing officer yet.
Well, and I know you don't want to speak too much to this because it's a sensitive issue. There's a process you don't want to jeopardize.
Right.
But, you know, he could still, he may not get it, and he could be deployed.
Right. And that's a terrifying thought for me also. I know I've received a number of emails, and some of them were extremely vicious and bitter. And if they're indicative of what any of the fellow soldiers would be feeling toward him, he'd be in great jeopardy if he were sent deployed overseas.
Yeah.
I worry for his safety. Not so much from the people were fighting, but the people who may be behind him.
So you got emails from Americans because they heard that your son was applying for CO status?
Correct.
But on the other hand, you also know that your other son is one of those soldiers in Iraq.
Right. I just know that if he had a CO next to him, that CO would be safe because Taylor would be protecting him as well as himself.
You've explained it before, but how do you explain how you can so support people with such different choices?
Right. I think it goes back to being a professor in social work, and that is that we teach self-determination. We live self-determination. And I believe everyone should have the right to make their choice on what they want to support.
And a mother has to support everyone.
Yes, and I would. If I had three sons with three different views, I'd support all of them.
Well, JP, we wish you well.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
I'm so worried for both of them, and I'm having a hard time modulating the voice at this moment.
I think that's understandable. Keep us posted.
Okay, will do. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
J.P. Burnham spoke to us from Johnson City, Tennessee.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Imagine if, right after September 11th, a New York firefighter sat down with a New York journalist and tried to tell her about his lost coworkers. Well, of course, that did happen in reality all across the city. And now that scene is being played out on the screen in the first feature film that tries to capture the emotional fallout from that day in September.
The thing is, I don't really know what to do. Call came and the guys went out and they haven't found them yet. But some of the families, they want to have a service now so that they can move on. And so I got to get up and I got to talk in church. I've been sitting in front of a piece of paper all day and I haven't been able to write a word, not a sentence. I just keep going into a clutch. I'm going to write under normal circumstances, but what am I going to tell those families?
Hey, it's okay. Maybe I can help. I've never written a eulogy before, but I've written some speeches.
How many did you say there were?
Eight.
Eight?
Eight men. I lost eight men.
A scene from the new film, The Guys, with Sigourney Weaver as the writer and Anthony LaPaglia as the firefighter, who needs help writing eulogies for his lost men. This film began as a series of workshop performances in New York's Flea Theater. Director Jim Simpson commissioned the work from Ann Nelson, who teaches journalism at Columbia University and had never written a play. And now Jim Simpson, Flea Theater founder, and his wife, actress Sigourney Weaver, join us in the studio to talk about the film, The Guys. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for coming in. Boy, as I went in to see this, my one thought was, what a dangerous proposition. Was there any hesitancy in the beginning to even think of commissioning it? Because you remember, it's hard to place ourselves back then, but there was this sense of art will never be able to reach the enormity of this event.
Sure. I mean, the genesis of it was actually very organic, though. It all started with a young member of my theater company that said, you know, Jim, you talk a lot about the theater being relevant and being part of our time. We need to respond with the theater to this event. And just by a series of real miracles, met Ann Nelson. She'd had this meeting with a fire captain where she'd actually helped him write four eulogies. And I met her at a time where I was able to say, hey, that sounds interesting. Why don't you make a play out of it? And she wrote something beautiful from it.
Well, in fact, I feel I should now turn to Sigourney and say, how did you approach being in something that was about 9/11? What were your thoughts?
Well, again, you know, we never thought it would become a movie. This was an effort to help perhaps the community downtown. And I think Anne actually writes about this crisis that a lot of people were having, which is we all wanted to do something, but, you know, we're not iron workers, we're not rescue workers. You know, what are we supposed to do? And so I think a lot of us, and certainly people even closer to the event than I was, you know, we wanted to offer this up.
Yeah. And now you and Anthony LaPaglia are playing the two roles on the big screen with a little bit of verite thrown in. There are some infrequent scenes in the film, fictional scenes, for instance, of you and your children in the film, let's say riding on a train, watching a man weep as he holds flyers. Such a little moment and becomes so big. But the main thread of the movie, the bulk of the movie, is just quiet conversations between these two characters, yours and that of the firefighter.
Well, I keep hearing, you know, these speeches from politicians on TV, hero this, hero that. I mean, I don't even recognize them.
Well, so that's why it's good you're doing this. I mean, you can give their friends and families something they can recognize. You can do that, okay?
I think the movie is about what happens when two strangers get together. One has been crippled by cataclysmic grief, and how a perfect stranger can pull him out of that just by saying, who are the people that were lost? What were they like? There's not a lot of talk about 9/11, what happened that day, but it's more about personalizing these men. All the firefighters in the movie are all the real deal. They volunteered to be part of the movie. Mm. They grace the movie with their presence.
You know, it also carefully colors the rest of us, and it feels as if your character, Sigourney, represents the rest of us. At one point, you say, hey, I'm a part of this, too. Mm. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons I responded to Anne Nelson's work was that she was so much more eloquent about it than I could be, and it felt so personal. Mm. That even if you didn't know anyone directly who was lost, you felt like you had lost someone that you knew very well. And somehow Anne, being on the outside of it, acknowledges how we all feel with this speech. She says, are you okay? That's what we all kept asking each other the rest of September. And then she goes through all the different concentric circles of loss. She says the pebble is dropped in the water. The point of entry is you, yourself. Were you present at Ground Zero and wounded, suffocated, or covered in white ash? No? I guess you're okay. And then she goes through all the rings around that, ending with, if you see a flyer of a missing person on the subway and you start to lose it, are you okay? Mm. And if one day all the flyers are gone, they're just gone, are you okay? Is anyone okay? And I would say that this was very much the feeling after 9/11 in New York.
Well, it's interesting. I wanted to ask you about what you've seen of audience reaction, because I know when I went in to see it, I realized how much it's almost like toxins and those feelings that I thought were never going to be gone. At a time, I thought that this is never going to wash out of my blood. I realized it had washed out of my blood because it washed back in when I went into the movie. And I'm wondering, how are you seeing people react to that, being put back? It's like a period piece, almost, and it's only a time 2 years ago.
Well, one of the fire captains who came last night in Albany said that when he had been working down at Ground Zero, he felt he had a pretty hard shell that had developed from fighting fires over the years, over 23 years. But working at Ground Zero, that shell was pretty much demolished. And he said he had the same feeling when he came back in to see the movie. He thought, you know, he had mixed feelings about coming, but he was very glad he had, because he said it took the shell off him again, and he felt those feelings again, but he was actually glad to have felt them again, because he didn't ever want to forget them.
Well, I want to thank you both for talking to us about it. The film is called The Guys, Sigourney Weaver and Jim Simpson. Thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
Sigourney Weaver stars in the new film, The Guys. It's directed by her husband, Jim Simpson. And The Guys is opening today in a few cities around the country, including Albany, Philadelphia, Boston, Portland, Oregon, and Washington, D.C.
Before we go, this recap of the day's developments.
U.S. troops are searching the tunnels underneath the airport in Baghdad looking for Iraqi soldiers. U.S. troops seized the airport overnight. A top Iraqi official speaking this morning said the facility would turn into a graveyard for coalition forces.
A new video of Saddam Hussein shown this morning on Iraqi television. It suggests he survived initial Allied attacks. The Pentagon says U.S. forces have so far been unable to shut down Iraqi TV. Meantime, CNN aired footage of what appeared to be the Iraqi leader walking through a supportive crowd. No word on when or where that footage was shot.
Thousands of Marines have been massing on the outskirts of Baghdad after defeating small groups of soldiers on their drive north. An Associated Press reporter embedded with that unit says the troops have not met significant resistance.
Kurdish forces have seized a key bridge near the city of Mosul in northern Iraq after relentless air attacks forced Iraqi troops to pull back.
Don North, an embedded reporter with the 101st Airborne Division, says the southern city of Najaf is now firmly under Allied control. He says Iraqis asked the troops to destroy a massive statue of Saddam Hussein there yesterday.
Another brigade or another battalion of the 101st put Bangalore torpedoes under a statue of Saddam Hussein. Saddam was mounted on a horse and dressed in medieval Arab warrior garb, and he was blown up off his pedestal.
Thousands of residents are fleeing Baghdad in a stream of bumper-to-bumper vehicles as anticipation of the siege of Baghdad builds.
Humanitarian aid is starting to trickle into the southern part of Iraq. U.S. Army Colonel David Blackledge says fresh water is now flowing in Umm Qasr.
We've got 7 tanker trucks that are distributing on a continuous basis from the water pipe that comes from Kuwait. There's more than enough water from Umm Qasr. You can't drink all the water that's flowing and coming in. In fact, we've got enough water to start distributing up north.
And Atlantic Monthly editor-at-large and Washington Post columnist Michael Kelly is confirmed dead after an accident involving a Humvee he was traveling in with U.S. forces in Iraq.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Stay tuned to your public radio station for the latest war developments.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.